Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Hello, hello, Buzzkillers. It's the old professor here again. And we are here once again with one of our favorite fellow professors, Professor Philip Nash from Penn State University, who talked to us about the Cuban Missile Crisis a few months ago and is here to talk to us about the atomic bomb in World War II. Good afternoon, Professor.
Good afternoon to you. Great to be here.
Thank you so much. Buzzkillers, we are trying to destroy as many historical myths as we can, and one of the biggest is about the atomic bombs dropped by the American military on Japan in World War II. And by biggest, I mean, of course, most explosive, most devastating, most...
Literally.
infected more people than anything else in world history, I presume, right?
Yeah. Although, I mean, we'll get to this. One of my arguments would be to put it in a context which is a little broader than some people do.
Right.
And, you know, if you look at the bombing of cities, it's not as major a watershed as you might think.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
No kidding. Okay. Yeah. Well, we'll get to that later. That's good. I'd like to hear something maybe about comparing it with the bombing of German cities and things
exactly.
like that. Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, one of the biggest myths we always hear, Professor, and maybe one that sort of starts the chronology going, right. is that there was, if you will, an affirmative decision to drop right. the atomic bomb.
Right.
Now, but before you answer that question, can you give the buzzkillers a little bit of kind of chronological context? Are we talking about early summer 45? We're talking about what time?
We right. Well, you know, the atomic bombs are dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August of 1945, mm-hmm. but that's the culmination of a long struggle to build bombs and deliver them. Most buzzkillers probably heard of the Manhattan Project, which
right.
is actually a top secret project during the war that built these bombs. But the origins of that is you really have to go back to 1939 when top physicists recruit Albert Einstein to contact Franklin Roosevelt because they now understand that it is theoretically possible to unleash the power of the atom
right.
and develop a deliverable bomb that will be orders of magnitude bigger than any other bomb ever developed. And the reason they contact Roosevelt is they're worried that the Germans might be well advanced along these lines because the Germans had – the physics in the 1930s was an international community.
Right.
The Germans had some of the top physicists themselves. These fears turned out to not to be really warranted. The Germans, Hitler in particular, dismissed physics as sort of a Jewish science.
Right. Because I think Leo Szilard, the guy who the physicist who
right.
came up with the original idea or the way to split the atom
right.
was Jewish.
That's right.
Einstein was obviously Jewish.
That's right.
I have to tell the killers and you that when I was an undergraduate, we had a special seminar on this and – the professor, for some reason, God rest his soul, wanted us to role play.
Oh, no.
And we had a fake decision meeting, and there was a Truman, there was everybody else, and I chose to play Leo Szilard.
Nice,
who has one role. It's just
you didn't have some students playing protons and neutrons and
no,
bouncing around the room, did
no,
you?
Okay, no, it wasn't that. It wasn't that technical, but. But we were essentially acting out something that never happened.
Nice. So there's a straight line from that to this, what
yeah,
you're doing
right,
right now, right?
Yeah.
In any case, so there is that is the major motivation, terror that the Germans might get a bomb in before we do.
Oh, well, sorry, I forgot to say, Szilard he left Germany in the 30s
right.
after he figured
yeah.
out things were going
along
bad.
With a lot of other folks.
A lot of other scientists, yeah.
And yeah, so and the Manhattan Project has physicists from all over the world.
Right.
And to the, you know, to the benefit of the Allies. The British start working on the bomb first, and then the Americans start. Manhattan Project is launched 1941, 1942, and it takes years to actually it's not a theoretical problem. And by the way, after the war, people like Harry Truman are going to talk about the atomic bomb secret, and there's really no such thing. Already by 1941, all physicists around the world understand this is not a theoretical problem. This is an engineering problem. For example, coming up with enough, isolating enough plutonium or uranium 238. I always get the isotopes mixed up. But yeah, a lot of the Manhattan Project are these massive complexes where they are refining plutonium or separating uranium isotopes.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Because Szilard thinks up the idea in the
yeah,
early 30s.
Yeah, he's the one who comes up with the idea that you can use fissile material to trigger a chain reaction, which will then generate an enormous explosion.
Right.
So in any case,
getting the stuff was hard.
Right. Getting the stuff, you know, plutonium is not something that occurs naturally.
Or is it Home Depot?
Right, exactly. Just can't go down to the big box store and order some fissile material. And so the Manhattan Project becomes this sprawling, massive project scattered across the United States. Cost $2 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Off the books.
Wow.
Which was a good trick during World War II. You had to appease investigating senators like Harry Truman, who were very interested. The so-called Truman Committee was supposed to investigate the war economy and defense contractors, and they were very concerned about where all this money was going.
We got to remind folks that Truman was still a senator because Roosevelt is president.
Right,
still.
Right. Roosevelt is the one who oversees and approves the Manhattan Project.
Right, right.
And
Truman's worried about in that committee, worried about graft and
backhanding,
that kind of stuff.
Exactly, and kickbacks and waste, fraud, and abuse, as we would say today. Yes, correct. In any case, so from the very beginning, there is, historians call it the assumption thesis, which is everyone assumes, at least in the top levels of government, everyone assumes that when this bomb is ready, we'll use it.
Yep.
Yeah. You know, I guess it's an interesting what if. What if the bomb is ready before the Germans have surrendered? Would we use it on a German city? Personally, I believe they would. If you look, and we'll talk about this, if you look at what they're already doing to German cities using conventional bombing, I don't think they would have held back if they thought the Germans were not close to surrender or refusing to surrender the way the Japanese were later on.
Right.
I think they would have dropped a bomb, but it wasn't ready in time. But keep in mind, the Germans are the original justification for this project in the first place. And so with the Germans surrender, this project does not stop for a second. By this point, it has a momentum of its own.
That's interesting.
You have scientists who are completely fascinated and sort of obsessed with solving this problem. You know, right? Once you devote 3 years and billions of dollars to something, you want to see it to completion. People are feeling the pressure, sort of a bureaucratic pressure, right? We have to show something for this. And the Japanese are still fighting.
Right.
They're fighting
casualties
hard.
Casualties are very high.
Casualties are extremely high. Yeah, we're in the middle of the Battle of Okinawa when the Germans surrender. And so this project goes full steam ahead. And they don't miss a beat. But the original justification for the project was the Germans. And it turns out, by the way, the Japanese had virtually no interest in nuclear research. The Japanese were not close to a bomb at all. The Germans were stymied at the point where before you can build a bomb, you have to trigger a chain reaction that sustains itself.
Right.
And we did it under a football field at University of Chicago in 1942, and we had discovered that you need a moderator, and we found graphite, which worked beautifully. The Germans never got to that stage. The Germans didn't stumble upon graphite. I don't think they would have gotten a bomb anyway. It was not a priority. Yeah,
right.
It was
they had two fronts to worry about, and they had
right. And they were putting all their resources into things like rockets and other things. And that's, you know, in retrospect, one of the great nightmares. What if they developed the V-2 and the nuclear weapon?
Right.
Because there's no defense against a V-2.
No. You shoot it from Germany and it lands in London.
Lands in London and game over. Right.
Right.
So that's – but yeah, there was a lot of concern toward the end of 1944, you know, trying to find out how far along the Germans were. In fact, we had teams of scientists who were following right behind our armies, basically gathering information, trying to find out what the Germans were up to. And it was called ALSOS, ALSOS. It was a top secret project to sort of find out how far along the Germans were. In late 44, we found out they weren't far along at all.
Right, but the project doesn't slow down for these reasons you mentioned before.
Yeah, in fact, we were so concerned that I think a little bit earlier than that, we sent one of our OSS agents, a former Major League Baseball catcher by the name of Mo Berg.
Oh, Mo Berg, yes, he's famous, yes.
He attended a public lecture by a German physicist in Switzerland during the war, and he had orders to shoot him after the lecture. In other words, if in the lecture he gave any inkling that the Germans were working on a bomb, after the lecture he was supposed to go up and shoot him, and he had a handgun in his pocket.
there's a biography of Mo Berg, something called The Catcher Was a Spy.
Yes,
or something.
Yes, correct.
And it's I'll put it on the Buzzkill bookshelf, Buzzkillers. But it's a great story.
Yeah, not a lot of major league ball players end up as spies.
Well, but he was also very smart. But I also think he if I have this right, and I'm trying to reach from my undergraduate days, he exaggerated his role could very well be. Anyway,
could very well be. But yeah, he was. He's also a would-be assassin.
Yes. So he's not just gunning down people at second base.
Right. Right.
So we have this assumption theory.
Right.
That as
the bomb
long
would
as,
be used when it's ready.
Right. Okay. So how true is this theory? How solid is this theory?
It's very good, and the reason it's very good is we have absolutely no evidence of any affirmative meeting being held where the subject of the meeting was, should we use the bomb or not?
Okay.
And we have, by the way, we have excellent evidence from the top secret documents released from World War II, including about the Manhattan Project. All that stuff's been available for years.
Uh-huh.
They had meetings. The most famous one is the meetings of the so-called Interim Committee, which was a top committee of scientists, and it was chaired by the Secretary of War, Henry Stimson.
Mm-hmm.
It met late May, early June 1945, but the topics of those meetings was how to use the bomb.
Right.
And also, what are some of the post-war implications of the bomb?
Okay, now when you say how to use the bomb, what do you mean?
Right, I mean, like, what sort of target you drop it on?
Okay, that's
when,
key.
Right.
Do we put it on a ship? Because Einstein had said, if you put it on a ship and sail it into a harbor, it'll destroy the whole city.
Right.
But they're thinking.
Well, no, I think they had already decided by this point how it's going to be delivered.
Right? Okay,
I mean,
they are
designing bombs that are air deliverable bombs. And by this point, we have the B-29 bomber, which is capable of doing it, barely.
Right, okay.
Because these bombs are very large and very heavy, and they barely got off the runway. B-29 project, which, by the way, itself cost more than the Manhattan Project.
Wow.
Yeah, that was a $3 billion project to develop the B-29, which was an engineering marvel of its own at the time.
No wonder they kept building those B-series bombers
forever.
Yeah,
and no wonder the Russians ripped off the design when they captured one of our B-29s and reverse engineered it. Yeah, no, it was the first plane with a pressurized cockpit.
Okay, so there's no peacenik in the cabinet, either under Roosevelt or after Roosevelt dies, Truman, or no peacenik in the War Department or on any of these Senate congressional committees saying, look, we should think about whether we should do
right.
This.
You had, there was one dissenter. There was an undersecretary of the Navy by the name of Ralph Bard.
Mm-hmm.
And he and also some of the scientists, so not in the cabinet, obviously, argued for a demonstration of the bomb.
Oh, now that's interesting. So that's
And that's one of the alternatives, which we can get to a little later on. In other words, you detonate a bomb. Maybe you go out to some island or something, and you bring Japanese dignitaries along, and you say, "Okay, look, here's our new weapon," and you set it off, and then that becomes you don't ideally it's sort of shock and awe without all the destruction,
without all the death. Yeah,
right. Exactly. Right. But. That was just Bard and not a bunch of other folks. Most people believe, the vast majority of the top policymakers believe, you use this thing in an effort to end the war as quickly as you can.
Right, and I meant peacenik in the most positive
right.
sense.
Right, right.
I didn't mean I'm one myself. Right. So
no, but no, you had now, and you know maybe as I've said, it maybe would have been nice to have a meeting where they actually. Get at root causes and talk about
the morality.
Decision, the morality of it. That would have been nice, or brainstorm possibilities for ending the war without using the bomb. But they never had that meeting.
Okay, so there's no such meeting. There is no such decision whether
right.
or not to do it.
Right.
But
in
you
fact, there's also excuse me if I interrupt you. There's actually also no written order from Truman. Drop the bomb on August 6th.
Oh no, kidding.
We have,
you'd think you'd need that.
The closest thing we have to that is a memo from the Secretary of War.
Hmm.
To the military authorities at Tinian, the island of Tinian, where the B-29s were
took
based.
Off from, yeah.
They took off from there. Yeah, we have that document. But we have no, which once again, I think speaks to this broader point, which is it's of course, when it's ready, drop it.
Because the president didn't authorize every other bombing. He didn't
correct.
Say,
right, exactly. You didn't have that level of micromanagement.
Tokyo, right.
Now,
right.
Maybe we can talk about this, but he did intervene and change the target list.
Okay, now that was one of the things you mentioned a minute ago, which was
right.
one of the decisions that they did have to make,
right.
or they did feel they have to make anyway.
Right, and so they drew up a target list because whenever in most bombing raids, especially these bombing raids, you have a target, but when the plane takes off, there are a lot of things that can go wrong, like with weather, for example, mm-hmm. or how much resistance you face, and so you have sort of a primary target, secondary target, tertiary target,
right.
And so you have a long list of targets. Overall, and you have a long and you have a short list of targets for each individual mission. But in any case, Stimson, the Secretary of War, was concerned about bombing Kyoto, which was a major Japanese city and a great cultural center.
Considered an ancient.
That's right.
The font, in fact,
I think
of
it was the ancient capital at one point. And so
right next to Tokyo as well.
Very close. Yeah, it's close. And so that was taken from the taken off the target list, as was Tokyo itself. And so then next on the list were cities like Hiroshima and Nagasaki. In fact, Nagasaki, that was not the primary target for the August 9th bombing. It was a secondary target.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Now, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, where would that fit in terms of the size of cities relative to Tokyo?
That's a good question. They're sizable cities, but not nearly as big.
Yeah.
Tokyo is a much bigger city. But there's another factor here, too, which is cities on the target list, like Hiroshima, were deliberately spared conventional bombing so that the impact of the atomic bomb would be more noticeable.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
So both for the size of the city and the type of, if you will, industry, the amount of industry going on, we're talking about like bombing Detroit.
Say. Right, or even a lesser city.
Really?
A lesser city.
Wow.
Yeah. But keep in mind, because by this point, the conventional bombing of Japanese cities has been going on for months.
Right.
And a lot of the major cities with major military industry in them have already been destroyed or largely destroyed.
And so the bomb wouldn't do anything.
Right. And for example, like Tokyo, and we talk about this, Tokyo was a quarter of it was flattened in March 1945 with conventional bombs. And so if you drop an atomic bomb on Tokyo, it's not nearly as impressive.
No.
In fact, I'm pretty sure there were some people in Hiroshima who, before the atomic bombing, sort of were marveling at their luck because their city hadn't been bombed the way all these other Japanese cities had been bombed. And so once again, there is this, once again, we'd call it shock and awe, but the idea is that you want to impress them. Look, we've been bombing your cities, but now we have a new weapon where all it takes is one to do all this. Mm-hmm. And that's much more impressive if you drop on a city that hasn't been touched yet.
Right. Okay. So Hiroshima then is, Buzz, cut that Hiroshima thing out there. So the big decision, if there was one, let me rephrase that. So there's no real decision whether or not to drop.
Correct.
The biggest decision by far is where.
Is where. And also, once you get to August 1st, the orders have already been sent down that you people on Tinian, you start bombing, dropping atomic bombs as they become available on the cities you have on the target list. Basically, whenever you see fit, when the conditions are right, when the weather's good, you go ahead and do it. So, in other words, the what particular day to bomb on and which city, those sorts of decisions were left to relatively low-level people.
Commanders on Tinian.
Commanders on Tinian, who had a great deal of authority on individual bombing raids.
And presumably, that's not that. I mean, they had to worry about weather and all kinds of other things. So, you get the local people.
Right, exactly.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, and so there's a certain logic to that.
So, there's no then decision whether or not to do it. But is it the only thing that is dropping the bomb? Is it the only thing that the U.S. can do at this stage? What were the sort of choices they had in terms of how to end the war?
By the way,
by this time, I just want to remind everyone that President Roosevelt has died and President Truman has taken over.
Well, and by the way, and if that's an important point, too, because that sort of reinforces the sort of assumption thesis. Harry Truman is very green when he comes in the office. He's got immense responsibilities. So much more than Roosevelt, he relies heavily on his advisors, and his goal obviously is to carry out Roosevelt's policies, right? He's not, even if he had, serious qualms about trying an atomic bomb, he's probably going to keep a lid on them.
Right.
Because he's not going to question his predecessor's policies. But, keep in mind where we are in the summer of 1945. Japan is, its cities are being systematically incinerated. The Americans completely dominate the skies over Japan.
Right.
Our bombing raids suffer very light losses compared to other bombing raids, say, in Germany. We're strangling Japan. We're doing successfully to Japan what the Germans tried to do to the British, which is to strangle them with a sea blockade.
Right.
One of the great unsung contributors to the victory in the Pacific are U.S. submarines.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
They're sort of tightening the noose around the islands of Japan.
Very, very little ship traffic is able to leave or arrive at Japan. The Japanese people are being starved to death, basically. They can't even ship reinforcements back and forth between Japan and Manchuria during this period, really.
So that's a quarantine that works really well.
Very well.
And that's
one of the alternatives is you allow this naval and air blockade to continue because it's another what if, but it's really hard to imagine the Japanese lasting any significant time in 1946, even from that one cause alone. We were not only bombing their cities, we were bombing their transportation network. They couldn't use their railroads. They were looking at mass starvation within a year. I think most historians would agree.
Okay.
But in any case, the Japanese are not surrendering. And the United States has just finished battles like Okinawa, where they only defend a quarter of the island. Mm-hmm. And American casualties are something like 13,000 dead. And the Japanese lose something like 250,000 dead. Soldiers and civilians.
Yeah.
And at one point in the summer, Harry Truman, you know, voices his worry about a string of Okinawas from one end of Japan to another. In other words, if you've just been through Okinawa,
yeah,
and you imagine, if you extrapolate, what would that be like invading all of Japan? You can imagine how nightmarish it would be. Wow. And the Japanese are not surrendering, despite, yeah, you know, any rational leadership in sort of world history would say, look, this is what we're up against. This is how poorly we're doing. We should throw in the towel. And they weren't. And it's partly because Soviet Union was still neutral in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
Japan was not at war with the Soviet Union. The Japanese were trying diplomatically to go through the Soviets and maybe negotiate a peace, the terms of which would be kinder to them than unconditional surrender, which, of course, people will recall was the official Allied policy on
right.
both sides in World War II, in the Pacific and in Europe,
now,
which,
wait,
is, which they, is unconditional surrender.
Were they using the Soviets as a possible broker
between
the rest of the
okay. Yes, right.
Not trying to make a separate peace with the Soviets.
No.
Because they're technically not.
No, but they're desperate, and they yeah. are when and they're in denial. The Japanese leadership throughout World War II is among its many many flaws. It's delusional,
wow.
And they think that they can somehow they in their more sober moments they know they've lost, but they want to get better terms. They want to hold out for better terms. And the whole idea of battles like Iwo Jima and Okinawa was, if we make this really, really costly for the Americans,
right,
they'll come to terms.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out the Americans are very, very determined and willing to absorb enormous losses in trying to crush Japan. But in any case, in the summer of 1945, someone like Harry Truman, Henry Stimson, they are looking for any way to end the war as quickly as they possibly can.
Right.
And now they have this new weapon available.
Okay, so The idea of invasion never really gets very high up the decision chain because
– No. It does.
Oh, okay.
It does. Yeah. No, I'm sorry. Yeah. So we need to complete this argument here. They are already planning to invade Japan itself because – and that's why you take Okinawa. Okinawa is technically Japanese territory. It's within easy air range of Kyushu, which is the southernmost Japanese island.
Right.
So the overall plan was called Operation Downfall, which mm-hmm. would have two phases. First phase would be Operation Olympic, an invasion of Kyushu scheduled for November 1st, 1945.
Wow.
Then that would take months, they guessed. And then that would be followed up with Operation Coronet, which would be an invasion of Honshu itself in March of 1946.
The main island of
Japan. The main island of Japan. Then you take Tokyo and theoretically then finally knock out Japan.
So we're talking about more or less another year.
Right. That's the plan. And this would have been a massive invasion. This mm-hmm. would have been on far larger scale than the D-Day invasion, for example.
Right.
It would involve, you know, by this point, we had like 100 aircraft carriers and thousands of aircraft. We had assembled the largest military force ever in human history by a long shot.
Right. And in theory, soldiers and sailors coming back from Europe could be redeployed.
Absolutely.
In the Pacific.
No, they talked to a lot of veterans. A lot of veterans have been interviewed from the European War who were looking for a brief period of rest, and they were going to be shipped to the Pacific.
Wow.
People like Paul Fussell, was a platoon leader in Europe, and he later wrote up a book called Thank God for the Atom Bomb.
Yeah, because he didn't have to go. Yeah.
Because he didn't have to go. And that's because there is, I think in the popular imagination, there's this dichotomy that, in fact, you can still find people who say, well, Harry Truman had no choice.
Right.
Because it was either drop the atomic bomb or invade Japan.
Mm-hmm.
That is far too simple. I wouldn't necessarily call that a myth, but it is a gross oversimplification.
Well, that's one of the things we're trying to bust. You know, oversimplifications
right.
and misconceptions
right.
are just as bad as myths.
Right. Truman had other options, and which were discussed at the time.
Mm-hmm.
One would be modifying unconditional surrender, the terms of unconditional surrender, because the sticking point for the Japanese is the status of the emperor.
Right.
Emperor in Japan is not like an emperor in other societies. The emperor Hirohito, on the throne since 1926, he was considered to be a direct descendant of Japanese gods.
Mm.
And so unconditional surrender to them meant, so in other words, you're going to come in here and do whatever you want, including take away our emperor. For them, that's a reason to fight on.
Yeah.
And so they had already, and there were people in fact, Stimson may have done this too. People were suggesting that maybe if you modify unconditional surrender, allow them to keep their emperor, maybe they'll surrender. And by the way, just for the record, that's what ended up happening.
Oh, yeah. Because
after we dropped atomic bombs, we sent them this sort of code language, our response to their latest letter, which was the Japanese emperor will be subordinate to the authority of the Supreme Allied Command or something like that. In other words, indirectly saying you get to keep the emperor.
Now, I wonder what, why the idea of unconditional surrender was so strong on the American side. Would the American public have cared whether – if there was one condition and that was the emperor, would they actually
have mattered? They would. Keep in mind that we're always refighting the last war,
there was
a lot of concern around the world, not just in America, that you might have a repeat of the end of World War I, which is where one side is really clearly defeated but doesn't recognize it.
Right, okay.
And that's the main reason behind it. I mean, it's also for propaganda purposes, right? You want to fire people up, and you want to say, join the struggle for a negotiated peace. You know, that's not a good bumper sticker.
No, it doesn't fit.
No, unconditional surrender. In other words, be uncompromising, completely stomp them, make it so there's no doubt who the winner and the loser is. That's part of it. But, I mean, look what happened.
It was conditional surrender.
Well, it was conditional, and they got away with it. I mean, it's almost like, declare a victory and go home. You know, it's not about what actually happens. It's the way you spin it. And as far as I know, there was no objections to the fact that the emperor – well, a lot of Americans would have loved to have seen him strung up or put on trial.
Yeah.
But as far as I know, there wasn't a major, major outcry about that.
Right.
By the way, there are other things, too. Because unbeknownst to the Japanese, the Soviets had agreed at Yalta – in fact, this was one of the big American goals at Yalta – they had agreed to join the war in the Pacific against Japan.
Now, was Yalta 43 or 44?
45.
This is as late as 45.
Yeah, this is February 45. This is FDR's last wartime summit meeting.
Right, okay.
And at that meeting, one of his main goals is to get the Russians to join the war against Japan. Further proof that we are having a hard time bringing Japan down, and we would love to have some of that Soviet manpower on our side like we did in Europe.
Exactly.
In Europe where, to put it crassly, Americans and British are fighting to the last Russian. To a large extent,
yeah.
right? If you look at the law, I mean, that's an exaggeration. But if you look at the losses, three quarters of the German army was tied down against the Russians.
That's right.
So in any case, we would love, because by 1945, the Red Army is a formidable instrument.
Mm.
And you see it once they finally do attack in Manchuria. They go through the Japanese forces like a hot knife through butter. In any case.
The Japanese forces in China.
In China. They had about a million men there, the Kwantung Army. In any case, there is hope. The Japanese are hoping to negotiate through the Soviets, and then on August 8th, so the timing is interesting, right between the two atomic bombings, on August 8th, that avenue closes when the Soviets do actually attack the Japanese.
Right. So they attack after Hiroshima, but before Nagasaki.
That's right. And it turns out it was pretty much 3 months to the day after because the Soviets at Yalta had promised, we'll attack Japan 3 months after the end of the war in Europe.
And what they did.
May 8th, do look at the calendar, May 8th to August 8th, that's 3 months. And so they attack, and so that closes off that avenue for the Japanese. And it's pretty clear, by the way, as long as we're busting myths, I think a lot of people would say, well, we dropped the bomb, and that's why the Japanese surrendered. That's a big part of it, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But another big part of it is that the Soviets have attacked, and that thing that the Japanese were clinging to, the idea of a negotiated peace through the Russians, that's no longer on the table.
Not only that, the Russians are actively fighting them. They're not going to be middle.
Correct.
Right.
And so, that becomes another option. You wait to see what the effect of the Soviet entry into the war could have been. There was also, we talked about the demonstration, right? You demonstrate a bomb first.
Right.
That's another option.
Yeah.
You could use some combination of these factors. So maybe I could just run through the list of options besides invading Japan or dropping the bomb. This would include modifying unconditional surrender, relying on the ongoing naval blockade and conventional aerial bombardment, which were slowly strangling Japan, demonstrate the bomb for Japanese officials, or waiting to see the impact of the Soviet attack. Because that had been this important avenue for the Japanese seeking a negotiated settlement, or some or all of the above in conjunction.
Okay.
Now, there's one other thing I'd like to add, which is just because they had planned an invasion for November 1st doesn't mean they were going to carry it out. We know now, for example, that and this gets into the whole idea of casualties from an invasion, but The estimates, the U.S. military estimates of the casualties of an invasion of Kyushu were relatively low in June. But by August, the Japanese had built up their forces in Kyushu.
Oh,
and so that invasion was then looking a lot more costly. Mm-hmm. And there was, before Hiroshima, there was talk among people like our Army Chief of Staff, George Marshall, already talk of either postponing or canceling Operation Olympic.
The first part of the invasion.
Right. So in other words, even if you don't do some of these other alternatives I've just discussed, it doesn't mean you're necessarily going to invade. Right. In other words, they might have ended up trying these other alternatives first just by default because they were worried about an invasion. In other words, they might have said, you know what, why are we invading November 1st if we're looking at such a costly invasion? Let's just wait and see if what we're doing is enough.
Okay.
So.
But in. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say. So, but basically, just to repeat the point, the idea that there's a simple dichotomy, in effect, Truman has no choice or anyone else would have chosen the same way because obviously you're not going to do an invasion. So then your only other option is dropping an atomic bomb. That's just not true.
Okay. So I'm what I'm starting to think of now are these pilots and commanders on Tinian.
Right.
Who, as we talked about earlier, didn't have to wait for an order from the president.
Yep.
So is it possible that, most of the decision, and I'm putting decision in quotes, Buzzkillers, was made by the guys who just said, okay, now it's time to go, let's go.
No, I wouldn't go that far. I mean, they've clearly been given an order to drop the bombs, but the actual implementation, what day to drop on, which city to drop on, that is sort of left to them. So in other words, the mechanics. But no, they have not been told, you go ahead and drop a bomb or don't drop a bomb.
Right.
No, they have said you drop a bomb, but the actual date and the actual target, that's up to you. That's up to your sort of standard operating procedures in the military.
Okay. But they're clear. So are they clear to do it or
yes.
not?
Yeah, they're clear to do it. They're clear to do it. And also they're cleared to drop all the bombs we have, which is two.
Okay.
Which is sometimes another question people ask, like, why do we drop two bombs? And the answer is because we had two.
Yeah.
And they're also trying to create – because among historians, there's a lot of criticism, more criticism of the second bomb.
Right.
Which, in other words, you drop the second one so quickly, it's like they didn't have a chance to react.
Yep.
And, you know, and then that's when we get into the sort of the delegation of power, because the fact that you had one on the 6th and one on the 9th, that was not decided in the White House or in the Pentagon. That was decided on Tinian.
Okay.
The timing of those. But there is also, I mean, I think there's reason to believe that they're trying to create an impression.
Right.
And it may actually have been necessary because there were some Japanese military people right after Hiroshima who said to themselves, apparently, I forgot where I read this, but apparently they said to themselves, well, obviously they only have one of those.
Yeah, that's such a new thing.
Right. Yeah. And it turns out we had two. And we're trying to, because, you know, when Truman issues the Potsdam Declaration at the end of July, he promises, quote unquote, a reign of ruin.
Yeah.
That the world has never seen. And so you drop two bombs and you hope the Japanese will conclude that they have this inexhaustible supply of them, which we did not. We had two. A third one would be ready around August 21st, maybe seven total by the end of 1945. But it's not like we had a factory where we cranked these things out.
No,
not
but
even
the,
close.
But the
they
Japanese,
were all hand-assembled.
Oh, wow. Handmade in America.
Lovingly handcrafted.
But the Japanese could assume or could think that the famous reign of ruin phrase just meant a ramping up of the firebombing.
Correct. You know, what, yeah, and there's been criticism of the Potsdam Declaration of being needlessly vague.
Okay.
Right, but, you know, I imagine, keep in mind, no one knows for sure, what if you drop this thing and it doesn't go off? Which, by the way, was an argument used against the demonstration idea.
Right.
What if you bring out these Japanese dignitaries and drop a bomb and there's just this big thunk?
Yeah.
Then what? Right? Yeah. Then it's worse than having no demonstration at all.
Right. Now, was there the possibility, though, that they could have decided on tightening this noose, keeping the Japanese starving, and also, and not planning to bomb, but then the commanders on Tinian... You know, it was a possibility of doing both in August and it was a mistake that the Tinian guys flew.
Right. But there's another thing to keep in mind, too, which is, you know, those people who sort of criticize the decision and say, well, you know, couldn't you have tried other things first? There are still Americans fighting and dying in many places in the Pacific.
Right.
There's still aircrew being shot down. There's still submariners being, you know, their lives lost at sea. And there is this, you know, you can do this thought experiment, right? What if you spend $2 billion, build this bomb, and then hold back? And the war goes on a couple weeks, a couple months later. And then later on, American parents of GIs and sailors and airmen who died after the point when you had the bomb ready and yeah. they find out you had the bomb ready and didn't use it, there's going to be a big political price to pay for that sort
how
of thing.
How could you right. possibly
right.
face those
right. parents? And right. once again, you just have to understand the mindset. The mindset isn't, is there any way we can win this war without using this new weapon? That was not their mindset. The mindset no. was, we're going to go all out, as we have been going all out for years, to crush the Japanese, and we're going to use everything at our disposal. And look, we have this new bomb. Maybe this will help. Mm-hmm. And so we'll mm-hmm. use it.
Okay. And so, then, yeah, that's right. Okay, sorry.
But. So, in other words, I was going to say, so I come up with this list, but in a certain sense, harping on this list too much is sort of ahistorical, because okay. Truman is not going through this exercise. In other words, is there any way we can end the war without dropping the bomb? That's not his mindset. That's not the mindset of any of the people around him, and understandably so.
And they're not having meetings about
correct. Yeah. Absolutely not. No, okay. they're having meetings about just about everything else, but not right. that.
Okay. right. So then the bombs are dropped mm-hmm. August 6th and August 9th, as mm-hmm. you say. And how many people do they kill, let's say, total?
Total, the two bombs.
In the immediate bombing.
The immediate bombings, I'm going to say about 150,000.
Okay. Not counting the radiation afterwards.
Right.
That stuff.
Yeah. And
okay.
there are people who die afterwards because of radiation. You're yeah. absolutely right. And then that is something new about this bomb. It's not just concentrated power, but also includes things like radiation. The Nagasaki bomb was the more powerful of the bombs, but the less deadly.
And that was Little Boy, wasn't it?
No, that was Fat Man.
Oh, yeah. Little Boy was
Little Boy
first.
Was Hiroshima, and
Fat Man was Nagasaki.
Yeah, and by the way, there are two different designs that work in different ways. The Fat Man, that's the plutonium bomb, it's an implosion bomb, much more complicated. That's the type they didn't think was going to work, and that's why they tested it in the New Mexico desert in July.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
The Little Boy is called a gun type bomb. It basically fires one radioactive mass into another in a straight line. They okay. knew that was going to work.
Yeah.
And so they didn't have to test that one. So they dropped it. By the way, it's a massive bomb. It's like 10 feet long, weighs like 5 tons.
Right.
B-29 struggles to get off the ground carrying this thing.
But because they knew the Nagasaki bomb would work, is that why they experimented, if you will, with the plutonium bomb for Fat Boy?
No. When they dropped them, they knew both would work.
Okay. Well, by the time they dropped
right.
them. Okay,
yeah, yeah. Gotcha, by the time of the bombing. But yeah, but in the development phase, they felt like they had to test the Fat Man because it was a more complicated design.
Gotcha.
You basically make this big, you have a nuclear core, and around it are these sort of very carefully shaped high explosive charges that form this sort of outer shell, and they have to explode in perfect unison to basically crush the interior and force it to go critical.
Uh-huh.
So if they're even like a half a second out of sync, it's just going to blow up and fizzle. It's not going to work. So they had to test that, and it was it worked really well. It vaporized a 120-foot steel tower and turned sand into glass and all this other stuff.
Oh my.
Yeah, it was an amazing. Anyway, so
150,000,
right?
Immediately.
Roughly, I'm going to say the figures vary a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to say roughly 60,000 dead in Nagasaki and maybe 80, 90,000 dead in Hiroshima.
No.
Even though the Nagasaki bomb was more powerful. And I'm talking 20,000 kilotons.
Right.
Sorry, 20 kilotons, 20,000 tons of TNT equivalent.
But there's a bigger population in Hiroshima, right?
My understanding is mainly topography. Nagasaki is much more hilly, and so parts of the city were shielded from the blast. But just for context, and maybe we can, I don't know when you want to get into this, the sort of the context of civilians dying in bombing raids.
Yeah.
But there were more people killed in Tokyo in March 1945 than died at Hiroshima.
Yes, that's right. Yes, that's something that people
and that,
never
I think that's another
about.
Common misconception. In fact, maybe I can share this with you, because I gave a talk on this. And I began by describing, without revealing what exactly I was talking about, I began by talking about a bombing of a city in Japan. And Japanese cities were certainly Tokyo, largely made of wood. A lot of interior walls were literally paper, so uh-huh. very, very vulnerable to incendiary bombing. In any case, the city burned fiercely, temperatures at one point reaching 1,800 degrees Fahrenheit. The frames of emergency vehicles melted. Water in canals and ponds were brought to a boil. Drops of liquefied glass drifted through the air. Citizens running for their lives or huddled in shallow shelters spontaneously combusted, were charred beyond recognition, or dropped dead from heat or suffocation. When it was all over, more than 250,000 buildings had been destroyed, 16 square miles, roughly a quarter of the city, up to 100,000 dead. That is not Hiroshima.
Right. That's the firebombing in Tokyo.
That was accomplished by conventional bombs, by thousands and thousands of tiny incendiary bombs, in other words, bombs that are designed to set fires.
Right. You'd think there'd be a limit to the point at which the heat would get, but apparently not.
Right. So in another case, if you look at sort of, if I can say this, the experience of the victims, there's not a lot different from being in a firestorm in places like Tokyo or Dresden or Hamburg and being a victim of Hiroshima. Now, like I said, there are things like radiation. There's the black rain that comes to Earth afterwards. I mean, there are differences.
Right.
But, you know, burned to death is burned to death. Mm.
Well, that explains very well the victims, the people who died in Japan. One of the stories, one of the misconceptions that's been probably since 1946 is that the bomb ends up saving lives.
Right.
In other words, if there had been an invasion, it would have cost X many lives and blah, 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 blah. So how far is this true?
Right. Well, that's a good question. And once again, stemming from the dichotomy, right, either invade or drop the bomb. And if you drop the bomb, you're looking at an invasion. Now, the invasion would have been costly. By any scenario, it would have been extremely costly to the Japanese. Mm-hmm. And not just Japanese soldiers, because the Japanese had a plan for the defense of the home islands known as Ketsugo, mm-hmm. which was authorized by the emperor and included reliance on, among other things, 5,000 kamikaze planes, and also involved, and this was for the defense of particularly Honshu, they were going to arm thousands of civilians with sharpened bamboo sticks.
Oh, my God.
And they were supposed to go after American Marines. So you can only imagine what the loss of life would have been, even in a small invasion, if that's how they're going to fight back. Mm.
Kamikaze in the air and kamikaze on the ground.
So the Japanese military certainly would have fought to the death as they had done on most of the islands that we had invaded. Right,
right.
Very few prisoners taken, as I'm sure your listeners are aware. So it would have been hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of Japanese casualties. So if your argument is the bomb saves Japanese lives, if the alternative is invasion, I think that's a safe bet.
Okay.
Then the question is how many American lives would it have saved?
Right.
And here's where I don't know if you're going to bust a myth necessarily, but you're certainly going to complicate the sort of perceived wisdom. Because right after World War II, people like Henry Stimson, Harry Truman, Winston Churchill even, they start to throw around figures like 500,000 or even 1 million U.S. lives saved. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly plausible if you look at things like Iwo Jima or Okinawa, right? If you extrapolate, you can imagine the Japanese fighting even harder, right? The islands are much bigger. You can imagine much higher loss of life. Well, in the 80s and 90s, we started to see evidence from inside the U.S. military that suggested that some of the estimates for U.S. casualties were far, far lower than that.
Some of the estimates given by the military itself.
By the military itself, top secret to Truman, especially in June of 1945. And, you know, these are estimates. They don't necessarily know what the actual casualties are going to be.
Right.
But if you take into account things like our air superiority, if you take into account things like the fact that the area around Tokyo, it's the Tokyo Plain, it's not rugged terrain at all. It's very, very flat, very open, not easily defended, that you can imagine coming up with some of these lower estimates. Now, a little later on, especially once the Japanese buildup on Kyushu begins, the estimates start to go up a bit.
Right.
Rarely do the estimates get up into the 500,000 range, which then raises an interesting question. Why are people like Stimson and Truman and Churchill, why are they throwing these really large numbers about? Well, it seems plausible to me that they're trying to justify something that had already become very controversial.
Right.
Right. Which is, some of you people don't feel right. You don't feel good about dropping the bomb, but look at all the lives we saved.
Right.
Now, by the way, you can make a legitimate or moral argument that if you even saved a few American lives, or maybe even one American life, right? We're at war. You're trying to end it quickly and save lives. You can make a moral argument that it was worth it. So I'm just acknowledging that from that standpoint, the idea, a lot of casualties, not so many casualties, that's sort of academic.
Right. But it's what's interesting to me is when you hear this argument, it's always, or at least when I ever heard the argument, it's always that the military told Truman that it was going to cost 1 million lives if we invade. And so there was this kind of official estimate.
Right.
And
I think the safer and more accurate thing to say is that official military estimates were all over the place, and some of them were surprisingly small, like maybe 63,000 dead in an invasion of Kyushu.
Wow.
You know, and part of the complexities here is estimates are often, sometimes it's just Kyushu, sometimes it's both invasions, right? Sometimes it's just the first 30 days of the invasion, sometimes it's the total conquest of the island. So a lot of the numbers are sort of like apples and oranges.
Mm-hmm.
And if you start looking into this, it quickly becomes very, very complicated.
Complicated.
My favorite word. I hate that. But so, in other words, I'm just sort of complicating the I think what's widely believed, because a lot of people become very defensive about dropping the atomic bomb, have very little patience for criticism.
Right.
And one of the things they quickly reach for is we were going to save 1 million lives. So, of course, it was worth it.
And that number seems to be so quickly arrived at, a million.
Right. Well, it's a nice round figure, and it's very, very large.
Right.
It's almost a way of shutting off debate rather than engaging in debate.
I never think about that, but that's absolutely
right. And it's like, I got nothing, right?
Right, right, right.
Now, I mean, it's pretty clear that the atomic bomb helped bring the war to a speedy conclusion.
But lots of people think that it was the bomb alone that led Japan to
see what I did there.
So,
nice segue. Yes. Yeah. No.
Buzzy, we're gonna have to cut that out.
First, there is a widespread belief that it is a simple one-to-one equation. We dropped the bomb, and because of the bomb, and only because of the bomb, the Japanese surrendered.
Right.
First caveat is we really don't know why the Japanese surrendered. Because the second they surrendered, top officials in the Imperial Palace and the Japanese government started furiously burning documents.
Wow.
And a lot of all the documents that we have, for example, on the American side, the equivalent, we will never get our hands on because they don't exist.
Right. So Tokyo's had enough firebombing, and now they're burning.
And now, exactly. Now they're relying heavily on their burn bags inside the Imperial Palace. Right. And so what that means is, from our standpoint as historians, in terms of evidence, we are relying on the post-war testimony of Japanese officials who, like all real people, often have an axe to grind.
Right.
And so, for example— try to save their bacon. In this case, quite clear they're trying to make the emperor look good. And so they create this picture of a Japanese government, which was deadlocked, which it was.
Okay.
And then the emperor intervening on the side of peace. And when he does that, he gives this famous public statement, which is the first time it's broadcast over loudspeakers in public in Japan. It's the first time the Japanese people ever hear his voice, right?
Wow, that's
amazing.
Remember,
he's sort of this remote godlike figure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're not supposed to hear his voice. And by the way, they also think he's above politics, which he isn't, but they think he is. Yeah. And so they spin this story in which he sort of comes down off Olympus and says, you know what? We've had it. We have to bear the unbearable, right? We have to bite the bullet and sort of end this. And by the way, and we're doing this because the Americans are using this evil weapon. There's language in his statement to that effect. Now, does that mean that's the truth? Is that the only reason they surrendered? Mm-hmm. We don't know for sure, but to the extent that we know, it's pretty clear there were other things involved, like the Soviet intervention.
Right. And which is sort of hanging in the north,
right,
about to happen any second.
Right, that avenue toward peace has been closed off. Mm. And also the fact that the Americans, a couple days after, so this we're talking about this very brief period between August 9th, the bombing of Nagasaki, and the Japanese agreement to surrender, which is August 14th, about a five-day period, during which, by the way, we're continuing to bomb their cities conventionally.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So the firebombing continues.
It's all part of this big strategy just to continue to pound them.
Right.
And during this period and after Nagasaki, the Japanese continue to insist that the emperor remain in place.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, would tend to reduce the role of the bomb, right? If the bomb is truly successful in achieving shock and awe, why don't they immediately surrender and say, okay, unconditional surrender? They don't. They say, yeah, okay, you drop these bombs on us. We still get to keep the emperor.
Yeah,
and then the Americans agree.
So
that's another reason they surrender, is that they get to keep their emperor.
Then that's a condition.
That's a condition.
So
that's a condition.
Unconditionally surrender.
Exactly. I mean, unconditional, it's a word like unique.
Yeah.
You can't say it's kind of unconditional.
But the American government let that go,
yes.
Right? It's just like, okay.
They did.
That's one,
they let it go.
One little problem.
Okay. They let it go.
All right.
So I think most historians would agree that the Japanese surrender for a series of reasons, including the atomic bombs, including the intervention of the Soviet Union and the modification of unconditional surrender. So it's sort of a package.
At least three reasons.
Right.
Wow.
Right. Now, by the way, once again, that doesn't necessarily mean that you shouldn't have dropped the atomic bomb.
Right.
But it was clearly important. And it is still amazing. We were talking about this earlier. It is amazing that in the statement, the official statement by the emperor, he says something along the lines of, the war has developed not necessarily to our advantage.
Right.
Which is, I think it has to be the greatest understatement in all of 20th century, if not all world history.
Right.
It's like if you look at the course of the war up to that point, Japanese not doing very well on pretty much any front.
Well, so. But the thing that's also so fascinating is that the bomb obviously is part of the end of the war, but it's also one of the big myths or one of the big stories or one of the big misconceptions or is that the bomb is part of – it's step one in the Cold War.
Right.
That the reason it was dropped by the United States is not only eliminate the Japanese but to scare the pants off the Soviets.
Mm-hmm.
How much truth is there to that?
Right. Well, and that's why, like, a lot of topics, including some of the ones you've covered on your show, including topics like, well, Reconstruction, for example, where sometimes the historiography, where the history of the history is sometimes more interesting than the history itself. And you see that in this case, too.
Okay.
And what happened is you had, after World War II, you had this sort of orthodox view, which was that Truman dropped the bomb. He had no choice. It ended World War II, and it was a good thing. Sort of end of story. And that lasted for about 20 years. In the middle of the 60s, not coincidentally, during the Vietnam War, right, the era of the New Left, a lot of young historians coming to the fore, right, big expansion of our university system,
right, and had a lot only of, been infants during the war,
yeah, right.
Yeah,
pretty much,
had
yeah,
not
there,
fought.
No, yeah. And you're right, and there is a real generational issue here too.
Yeah,
and we start to see some of the first declassified documents, including, for example, here Henry Stimson's diary.
Oh,
and so then you have this new wave of historians called revisionists, who make various claims, the leading one being that this wasn't actually dropped to end World War II. It was dropped, as you said, as the first shot in the Cold War. In other words, to intimidate the Soviets.
Yeah, that the Truman administration is thinking two steps ahead.
That's right.
Yeah.
11-dimensional chess.
Yeah.
Right. And it's not the last shot of World War II. It's the first shot in the Cold War. And the subtext is that this was unnecessary and really sort of a callous and even barbarous act because it was unnecessary. Right? A lot of revisionists argued that the Japanese were trying to surrender.
Mm-hmm.
Garl Pervitz is probably the leading and most sort of extreme promoter of this view.
But do we get any – is there any evidence that Truman's thinking this or MacArthur or Stimson or anybody?
Truman, a good question. Truman, not so much. But if you look in various sources – well, actually, with Truman, the proof is in his action because if you look at his behavior at the Potsdam Conference.
Right.
In the middle of the Potsdam Conference, he gets the news about the successful test in the New Mexico desert. And everyone, including Churchill, remarks on how his behavior changed and about how he's much more sort of forceful and assertive and sort of, you know, walks around like he owns the conference. And there are people who remark on it like, well, now I understand what happened to him, right? He just got this really good news.
Right.
And Stimson in particular is very aware of this. He writes in his diary as early as May, he's talking about how, well, you know, we want to go into these conferences with the Soviets with our master card in our hand,
mm-hmm.
i.e. the atomic bomb. So these days we have, in terms of the historiography, we have, I would argue, a consensus, which you could call post-revisionist. Which is, it's more orthodox than revisionist. In other words, most historians today would agree that the main reason that this bomb is dropped is to end the war quickly.
Mm-hmm.
However, a secondary reason, part of the mix, is the fact that the Soviet Union was increasingly difficult to handle.
Right.
We were already, if you look at the Potsdam Conference, you already see the seeds of the Cold War. You already see, mm-hmm. even during World War II. Soviet Union, very, very difficult ally, to put it mildly.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the way they are sort of already starting to communize Eastern Europe, they're not cooperating in the administration of occupied Germany. So there is a good motive. And by the way, they also want to end the war quickly to avoid having the Soviets take part in the occupation of Japan. Right? We've already seen what it's like to split a defeated enemy with them in Germany. We don't want to repeat that. If we don't drop the bomb, the war lingers on. The Soviets attack in Manchuria. Maybe they can then say we deserve a share of occupying Japan.
Oh, so it's an added benefit, but not necessarily a decisive.
So I think most historians would say that it's reinforcing, it's secondary, it's a bonus. It's one of several reasons.
Mm.
But the main reason is shock and awe. Try to end the war quickly.
Well, the apart from shock and awe, the word shock and awe, turning into the word quickly, Buzzkillers, the words we keep using in this conversation are complicated, complicating, mm-hmm. Multiple reasons, multiple motivations. So is it any, is it any wonder something as big as the atomic bomb has generated this many myths and this many misperceptions?
Yeah. And controversy. I mean, it's been, it's been over 20 years now, but in the mid-1990s, there was a huge controversy, entire books written about it, about the display of the Enola Gay at the Smithsonian Institution.
I don't remember
that. And this was a huge, and it was actually at the time, 1994, 95, it was actually part of what we now call the culture wars. Huh. Right? This 94, that was the Gingrich Revolution. That was when mm-hmm. the Republicans recaptured the House of Representatives. There was a lot of pushback against political correctness, quote unquote, which is when that term was first thrown around quite a bit.
Coming up on the 30th anniversary of the end of the war.
Right.
In theory, that could have been
exactly.
A thing.
Yeah. 40th anniversary.
Sorry.
50th anniversary.
No.
We're historians, not mathematics, not mathematicians.
No, 90,
yeah, 45,
90,
45 90. To 95 is 50 years.
And that's
what it was time to do.
All right, Buzzy, we're going to have to fix that one too. Sorry.
In any case, so they were going to, not the whole plane, but they were going to refurbish the front, the nose, and the cockpit of the Enola Gay and put it on display. And they were going to embed it, and this was probably their mistake in retrospect, they were going to embed it in a big exhibit about World War II.
Uh-huh.
And this was done by historians and curators at the museum, and it included language, some of which in retrospect was unfortunate. They wanted to... they wanted you to understand the Japanese viewpoint, not necessarily justified, but to understand it. And that distinction between understanding and justification is lost on some people.
Right, right.
In any case, a lot of people, including a lot of folks in the Air Force Association, went berserk.
That's sort of the Air Force Alumni Association.
Yes, pretty much. Who have a lot of friends on Capitol Hill. And remember, the Smithsonian Institution is paid for with taxpayer dollars.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people,
Air and Space Museum is the most popular museum.
Absolutely.
All kinds of stuff.
It's a big deal. And so a lot of people on the right figured, look, this is a nightmare. Your tax dollars are being used to pay for left-wing myths that are supposed to make Americans feel bad about World War II.
Mm-hmm.
That's how, and by the way, and not feel so bad about what the Japanese did. That's how some people sort of spun this.
Yep.
And basically, they ended up just displaying the Enola Gay without any display at all, without any sort of
explanation.
Right.
Okay.
And it raises fundamental questions. Like, for example, what is a museum for?
Right. Right.
And I don't have a clear answer to that. I mean, is it so you should feel good about your country? Or is it to educate you?
Right.
Right. Is it to complicate things like we're doing here? Or is it to not complicate things? And then some of these historians and curators walked right into a buzzsaw. Pardon the expression.
that's a good place to wrap up, Professor, because what we're seeing is that everything seems to get more complicated, and every topic we come up with then spins off three or four more topics.
Right.
So the show's going to go on forever, Buzzkiller, so you'll be glad to hear that. So listen, thanks again, Professor.
My pleasure.
It's been, once again, the Cuban Missile Crisis and then this show have been most, most illuminating, and we'll talk to you next week, Buzzkillers.
This is Aunt Ginger from Professor Buzzkill, and you're listening to the Epicast Network.
Epicast.